Hey everybody, this is Sierra. I was just jumping on. You are here for the Fair Housing Act training, the last one, part five. So this is going to be a little bit different of a format today because we're going to be doing some breakout groups. So let me know if you need any help with technical assistance, and we'll get started in just a bit. Hey everybody, welcome to the Fair Housing Act Training Part 5. We are going to get started in just a few minutes, so thank you for joining. If you need anything, please just put a message down in the chat box on your screen and we'll get started in just a bit. All right, hey everybody, good afternoon. I am Sierra Royster, April's Youth Program Coordinator. I want to thank everybody for joining us for part five of the April Youth Advocacy Committee training on Fair Housing Act. Today we're going to be talking about raise the rent. Where is the affordable housing? So the burning question that everybody has and makes housing almost impossible feeling at times, we're going to be tackling that. We hope that this training has been really informative and helped you grow in your knowledge and in your hopefully your advocacy going forward. We again want to just thank the sponsors of this training, the Research and Training Center on Independent Living at the University of Kansas. So we thank them for supporting us. That allows us to keep supporting youth. So thank you for that. Today is going to be by a webinar system. And you can follow along with the PowerPoint materials that were sent to you yesterday with the call-in information. Please know that we are going to be breaking out today. So we're going to be using that PowerPoint until we get to the end, and then we're going to be doing some small group sharing on a webinar platform. So it will be lots of fun. If you run into any issues throughout the time that we're together today, please just drop in the chat box if you need to a message. You could also send me an email. That email is April, APRIL dash Sierra, SIERRA, at att.net. I'm also going to drop it into the chat box in a minute as well. So you can catch me if you'd run into any technical troubles. And then if you have downloaded the latest version of Zoom, you will be able to join by microphone today, and I encourage you to do that as we're going to be joining in the small groups later, and so we'll need you to chat it up there. That's where we're going to get a lot of good ideas from. And if you are on the phone, you can press star six to mute and unmute yourselves once I have unmuted all lines. And if you would like, you can press star nine. That will let me know you have a question, and that just shows me a hand is raised. So just remember, when you are joining into the conversations later today or during the presentation itself, please just remember to keep the background noise down as much as possible. That way we can hear you clearly and everybody else can hear what you have to say as well. Today's webinar is being recorded, and there is a transcript for today's call that will all be sent to you afterwards. And then it will also be all of the series, all five parts, will be uploaded to our website, hopefully even by next week. So you can access those ongoing from there, along with the PowerPoint material. If you are preferring cart today, you can do that by going to the bottom of your screen, and you'll see a menu bar that will pop up. There is a mute button all the way to the left. There's a microphone. If you click that, that will mute or unmute you. And then you can also start your video on the platform that we're using today. So if you want to join us by face, you can do that as well. And then there is a CC box that will allow your cart to pop up so you can see the transcript. If you prefer to have the transcript in or the captioning in a larger view, you can do that by following the stream text link that was sent to you with the original email, but I will also drop it into the chat box as well. You can also find in that same bar a little bubble with dots in it, and that is the chat box too. So thank you all for joining us. I'm going to go ahead and unmute our speakers, and then I'm going to allow everybody to unmute yourself. So if you want to join in the conversation, you're more than welcome to do that. Thank you again for joining us. I'm going to turn it over to Don and Dylan. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Sierra. All right. I'll get it going. Welcome, everyone. Oh, sometimes it does this. It doesn't like to show the picture, but that's all right. So week 5, thanks to everyone for sticking around for an entire month to get to one of, in my opinion, one of the most important topics, affordable housing. And to start us off, I've got a graphic here from a report called The Gap. And this report came out of the National Low Income Housing Coalition this year in 2019. And if you haven't heard of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, you should research them. They've got a lot of really fascinating reports about housing affordability and the disparities in current wages versus what rents are available right now. And as you can see in this, well, if you can see this graphic, if you can't, I will describe it for you. It says, the problem, the U.S. has a shortage of more than 7 million rental homes, affordable and available to extremely low-income renter households, right? So we have a lot of extremely low-income renter households, people who don't have a lot of money, and the number is around 7 million. That's how many houses we would need in order to be able to house all of the people who currently need housing. The solution that they offer is to increase capital investments and rental assistance programs, right? And so this is a lot of kind of mumbo jumbo. So we're going to take some of these terms and try to define them over the next few minutes so that we can talk about this problem more in depth and make sure that everyone is on the same level of understanding, right? And so to start us off, Don is going to give us some background definitions.
Thank you, Dylan. So, you know, a basic definition of a household includes all the persons who are occupying a housing unit. And so when somebody's asking about that, they want to know if it's a single person household, single parent family, which can be, you know, just the one person with one or two kids, a couple without children, a couple with children. So occupants can be all of those, but it has to be defined. They always ask that.
Yes, and also a group of unrelated people who share a living space. Really, the definition of a housing unit is if you share a kitchen and like public dwelling area. So if you have a living room and a kitchen that you share with other people, then you share a housing unit with them. Otherwise, they're separate households or separate dwellings if you have a different kitchen or a different household or a different living room.
Right. And they will actually look and see how you have that separated too, especially with food stuff and that type of thing. If you label it and do that. Income, it's just basically the money that you receive on a regular basis, whether it's through Social Security, through SSI, work, if you have investments, just whatever type of income that you have. A lot of times people will want to know that you have enough income coming in to be able to pay for the rent. Minimum wage is the lowest wage permitted by law or by a special agreement if you're with a labor union, and that varies by state to state. And that's a big problem. Like, I live in Sioux City, Iowa, which is in the northwest part of Iowa. You can go 5 minutes into Nebraska and earn almost $2 more per hour, or go up to South Dakota and earn, you know, a $1.40 more per hour. So, you know, it's trying to bring some sort of consistency across the United States. If you look down south, a lot of the southern states don't have any laws at all, like Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama. They don't have a law, Tennessee, they don't have a law at all what their minimum wage is. And you've heard, you know, for the past, years or so about the $15 minimum wage, it makes sense when you have these state minimum wages being this little. So it makes sense to me. Anyway, I don't want to.
And I was reading into why some of those southern states don't have a law regarding minimum wage, because there is a federal Fair Labor Standards Act that was passed that passed a federal minimum wage of $7.25. So right. For any job that you are, like, for most jobs fall under that. There are a few exceptions, but the vast majority of people who get hired to do a job are protected under that federal law and will make $7.25 an hour, even in those states like Montana or Wyoming, where they have a lower minimum wage on the books. And the reason that the politicians say that they still have this lower minimum wage is to demonstrate to companies that they are more favorable, more agreeable to the company than to the worker. And that, I don't know, that kind of squeaked me out when I read that. These politicians are very proud to announce that.
And there are stuff, like in Iowa in 2016, a lot of like counties passed larger minimum wages. And then that was overturned because they said counties could not do that. So it's just, it makes it harder for people to get by. But yeah, you're right. With the federal minimum wage, they do have to have at least $7.25 per hour.
So. Yes, unless there are some exceptions, like people who do seasonal work, some farm labor jobs, and some people with disabilities, there is an exception for that. Some like sheltered workshops are able to pay less than minimum wage. You're shaking your head. Has that been struck down?
Well, no, it's just a terrible practice.
I know there's always a lot of debate around whether or not that should be allowed, but a lot of places do pay workers with disabilities less than that minimum wage, and that is a legal practice.
Right.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about some kind of more heavy statistical ideas. I don't want you to get too bogged down in the math of trying to understand this, but these are terms that get used as like benchmarks to define what rent is acceptable, what a maximum rent should be. And so I want to be able to make sure we understand the idea behind what these terms mean. So one of those terms that gets talked about a lot is median family income. And so imagine you take all of the people who live in a place, right? That could be the United States. It could be Texas. It could be Fayetteville, Arkansas, right? Wherever you take the specific place and you line all of those households up, right? And you say the people who make the least amount of money are over here. And then you line them up in order of how much money they make all the way to people who make the most amount of money on this side. Right. Median family income is an imaginary house that's right in the middle of that line. So it's not a real family that we're talking about, but it's getting an idea of an average, what the average family who lives in this place makes. And I know average and median are different technically, but just trying to get the idea of what the most people who live in that place, what their income is. And as you can see in this chart, it's different based on the where you live. In Atlanta, Georgia, the median family income is $57,016 a year. Cincinnati is $59,000. Los Angeles is almost $70,000. Seattle is $75,000. And then St. Louis, Missouri is about $57,000. And so that means half of the households in those places make less than that amount of money, and half of the households in that area make more than that amount of money. And that median family income is used to determine what's considered low income. And that's, I think, a term that we use a lot, is low income housing or low income household. And each individual area has a different cutoff as to what counts as being low income. But how they determine that is the same. It's 50% of that median family income. So the actual number is going to be different based on where you are. So like in Atlanta, median family income was $57,000 a year. So for a household of one person to be considered low income in Atlanta, Georgia, you'd have to make $26,200 or less every year. And that number goes up if you have more people in your household. So two people who live in a house together could make $29,950 and still be considered low income, right? It's a little more money, but that's because you have another person in there. And honestly, that doesn't seem like much of a jump to me.
Hey, Dylan, this is Sierra. I just want to clarify, when you say two people, that means two contributing people, right? Like that wouldn't be like a parent and a child would count as two.
No, because a parent, the point of capturing that is to say that like even one parent working by themselves, if they make $29,000, they're still supporting two people. And so it's unfair to say, well, your $26,000 should go to support you and your child.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Very good question. Yeah. And so again, that low income cutoff is going to differ based on where you live. It's the highest on this list in Seattle because Seattle had the highest median family income. And there's also a distinction between a low-income household and an extremely low-income household. An extremely low-income household makes 30% of that median family income. So in Atlanta, for a one-person household, an extremely low-income household would make $15,750 per year. And that extremely low income household, remember, that's the group of people we were talking about at the very beginning of the shortage of housing, the short 7 million houses that were short, is for these people who make 30% of the median family income or less every year, which is a significant amount of people, 7 million people across the country who aren't able to find affordable housing because they make often, we'll talk about how much you have to make per minimum wage in a little bit. And if you look at the breakdown of those extremely low-income renter households, we've got shows here the percentage of where those groups of people fall. 39% of those extremely low-income households have someone, at least one person in the house who works a job. And, oh, I've got my cameras blocking this. So 43% of those people work 40 hours a week or more. 34% work 20 to 39 hours a week. So that's three quarters, almost 80% of people who are in extremely low income renter households work at least part-time and are still not able to afford housing. 22% of extremely low income renter households are people who are disabled. So this is a problem that affects people with disabilities in particular. And that doesn't count the 26% of people who are seniors who may also have disabilities. So that's a significant percentage of people with disabilities who fall into this extremely low income category. So if there aren't enough affordable apartments, it's going to be a problem for people with disabilities. And we can look at that income distribution across race and ethnicity because this is a problem that disproportionately affects indigenous, Black, and Hispanic families. If you look over on the left, about 38% of American Indian or Alaskan Native households fall into that extremely low income portion. And it's over 50% of American Indian or Alaskan Native families fall into the very low income or extremely low income. Compared to if you look at white non-Hispanics, it's 22% extremely low income, 14% very low income. So it's a problem that affects people across ethnicities, across races, but disproportionately affects American Indian, Black non-Hispanic and Hispanic communities. Those people are, there are a lot more people in those communities than in white communities who are experiencing this housing crisis. Any questions about what we've talked about so far? Because I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit.
I just had a comment, Dylan. On the very right column where it says other or multiple, mm-hmm. You would think that if they had multiple, if they were multiple race or other, they would be more impacted also. And actually, they're not. It shows on here.
Yeah, that was, I think, probably the most interesting piece of that. So the largest, it has the largest portion of families who earn above the median income is in the other or multiple races category, which I guess there are a lot of different cases that could fall into that. So it's kind of hard to even talk about who would be in there.
Yeah, it was just interesting. So. Yeah,
interesting, for sure.
And this is Sierra. I just wanted to give everybody a note again. If you would like to join in the conversation or ask a question at this point, you can Everybody is unmuted or has the ability to unmute yourself now. And you can do that by the microphone in the bottom of the screen or pressing star six if you're on the phone. And just one more note, if you look in the chat box, I did drop in upcoming dialogue that's going to be happening on section 14C, which really focuses on the subminimum wage conversation that was mentioned briefly here. It actually allows you to ask questions and submit comments about it, and then those will all be discussed on the conversation in June. So I put that link on there that you can register for if you're interested.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions about income before we start talking about rent prices? Still going to stick with stats and graphs for a minute. I apologize. Okay. So, it's doing this thing. Okay. So another term that gets talked about a lot is fair market rent. And that's usually the number that is determines your Section 8 voucher, how much subsidized apartments will cost, or determines a lot of how housing authorities determine their rent prices is based on what the fair market rent in a particular area is. So kind of like we did earlier with the households, where you lined them up in order of how much money they made from low to high, imagine you take all of the vacant apartments, and I guess this even goes for apartments that people are living in, and you take the one that is cheapest with the lowest rent and put it over here, and line it all the way up to the highest rent over here. And you get a curve that looks kind of like a bell, because most of the rents are going to be somewhere in the middle. And the fair market rent is where that red dashed line is on the 40th percentile. So whatever that number is, that's what's determined to be the fair rent price for that area. So 40% of the apartments in an area are going to be that price or cheaper, and 60% of the apartments in the area will be that price or more expensive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you'd think if it was the fair market rent, it would be a little closer to the middle, in my opinion, but that's how it was determined. It's the 40th percentile, not the 50th percentile. And it's, again, this fair market rent amount is going to be different in every city because it's based on how much the apartments in that area cost. And some places like Atlanta determine it based on individual zip codes. Most places go for the whole city and look at apartment prices within a metropolitan area. Atlanta's really specific. They go per zip code. And you can see the range is pretty wide, from $640 to a studio up to $1,400 for a studio, depending on which zip code you live in Atlanta. And some places like Cincinnati and St. Louis actually have relatively low rent prices compared to Los Angeles and Seattle, where a one bedroom can run you $1,300, $1,500, $1,600. And that's just the fair market rent. That doesn't count the luxury apartments that cost more than that, because this is only the 40th percentile, remember. Okay. So kind of bringing things together, how much people make, how much apartments cost. Right here, this is a huge chart. It's got all of the counties in the United States broken down and separated by color. The lighter blue counties are where you have to work. It's we're talking about how many hours you have to work at a minimum wage job to afford a one bedroom apartment. So in the light blue counties, that's where you work 40 hours a week or less in order to afford a one bedroom apartment. And from what I can count, there are less than 20 of those counties that fall into that really, really light blue color. The vast majority are somewhere between 41 and 80 hours a week being needed to afford a one bedroom apartment if you're working a minimum wage job. And if you look in some of the bigger cities, we've got these really, really dark blue dense areas around like San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Washington, D.C., Miami, even in Texas around, I think that's like Austin and Houston, where a lot of the times it takes more than 80 hours working every week at minimum wage jobs just to afford a one bedroom apartment at a fair market rent, right? That's only 40% of the rents of that area. And if we're talking again specifically about those extremely low income renter households broken down by state, for every 100 extremely low income renter households, on average, we have about 40 affordable apartments, 40 apartments that someone who makes 30% of the median family income or less every year would be able to afford. And in some states, like Nevada is the lowest, there are only 19 available affordable homes for people who cannot afford extremely high rents. So this is a national crisis, something that we're experiencing all over the country, of people not being able to find housing that they can afford or spending more money than they should have to on their housing. Because the Department of Housing and Urban Development says you should only spend 30% of your income on housing every year. But when you're working minimum wage and you have to be able to pay it, a lot of times people spend 50, 60% of their income on rent, which is, it's a burden. It's a very significant burden upon people. And I believe this is one of the last graphs we have. This is the each state broken down by how much money you would need to make per hour in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment working full-time. So one person working 40 hours a week, how much would they need to work, make an hour to afford that home? And even the cheapest places are like Arkansas, $13.84. I don't think Arkansas's minimum wage is that high. I think their minimum wage was $7.25 or somewhere around there. And some of the more expensive states, Colorado, $23 an hour. Washington, almost $27 an hour. California, $32.68 an hour. So there, we just see more and more what people make is not enough to afford the rents that are available to them. So we've seen this crisis, this problem exists. So what do we do about it? Okay, got one last one.
Dylan, I have a quick question for you. Yes. Back on that slide. I am assuming that, because you said it was suggested that 30% of your income go towards home, like the rent. Is this number on the out of reach yet? That one, is that the 30% of their income to be able to meet that, or is that their whole income?
If someone in Texas made $19.32 an hour working 40 to 40 hours a week, then 30% of their income going towards rent would cover the fair market rent.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Okay. And so this is a list of what rents would be available to people in those separate income categories that we've discussed and some that we haven't discussed. So for a household that relies on Social Security, if they're only spending 30% of their income on rent, that they should only be spending about $250 on rent. And I don't, that's just never, I've never seen an apartment for $250 anywhere. For one full-time worker who earns minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, if they're only spending 30% of their income on rent, then they would spend $377. An extremely low income household or a household that earns 30% of the median family income could afford a $660 rent. And as we've talked about rent prices a little bit, all of these are still out of reach. Even to someone who makes the average renter wage, what most people who rent in an area, how much money they make, it's still less than what they're spending on rent, which tells us that most renters are spending more than 30% of their income on their rent. Right? And if you want to have a one-bedroom apartment, then it's going to be $931. Two-bedroom apartment, the fair market rent is $1,149. So what's there is inaccessible to what people have. There isn't enough money to pay for these houses. So, Dawn.
Sorry, Dylan, I have one more question.
Oh, yeah, no. Questions.
Graphs spark lots of questions for me. So I see the bottom two say either the one bedroom and two bedroom, but they say for fair market rent. Does that mean the other ones were not considered fair market rent?
This is the national fair market rent, right?
Okay, so all of it is.
Yeah, so okay. Like nationally, the fair market rent for a one bedroom apartment is $931. What this is saying is a rent, if you're taking 30% of the income of a person who relies on SSI, that's $250. 30% of the income of a federal minimum wage worker is $377. 30% of an extremely low income household's family income is $660. So all of these rents that HUD would recommend you pay, where they would recommend capping your rent payments, are below this fair market rent, which means that it's very unlikely that those families would be able to find a place with a rent that is affordable to them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I guess my question is, so this is not based on like, and since doing these webinars now, I'm confused on how to say it properly, but like the subsidized housing, the income-based housing kind of stuff, that is not based on this, right?
Typically, no. If it is, they will use the fair market rate number that is whatever area you live in. So they may say the fair market rent in Raleigh, North Carolina is $1,100. So then your rent is 30% of that, which would be different from an income-based subsidized program, which looks at how much money you make and says, whatever that is, we're taking 30% of it. Okay. So it differs based on the program and a lot of things. And I feel like I'm just confusing everyone the more I explain it.
No, I think that helps. Okay. I don't know. Sorry if I confused anybody out there. Feel free to ask questions too.
This is Dawn, Dylan, if I could. And I would say also that, you know, each city has its own little microcosms of areas that have different fair market rents also, and different reasonings why rents are more expensive. For example, some areas have plants that come in, and so they bring a lot of workers in, and the rents go way up. And that can push out a lot of people with that had been renting, and especially people with disabilities, they cannot then afford, you know, what has all of a sudden fair market rent has increased so much.
Yeah, if there are more expensive apartments, what's considered fair market rent is going to go up as well.
Right. So, I mean, there's so many different scenarios that can happen. Like even when I moved here to Sioux City, I ended up buying a house just because it would be cheaper for a mortgage than the rent, because the rents here are like $1,400 a month for a one bedroom house. So some places are ridiculous, but then it ebbs and flows too. So it's just kind of knowing your area and keeping tabs on your area as you're helping people finding housing too. If that helps.
Great. Thank you. No, that's helpful.
So Don, why is the rent so high?
Oh goodness. why is the rent so high? Well, so most real estate now is owned by companies, not your mom and pop who owned this building and, you know, they would work on it and they would, you know, enjoy it and you could pay them rent. It's now it's a corporation, and there's some corporations that are really good, but it's about money. And
yeah, I see someone has commented, landlords make improvements. So I'm assuming that you're saying that rent is expensive because landlords need to be able to take that money and put it back into the building and be able to make improvements, which is true. But the vast majority of their profits are not used for that. The majority of the profits go into bank accounts. So like real estate is a business. And yes, some rent does go up in order to make some improvements. But if I'm being frank, those improvements could be made and could be paid for with the amount of profit that is currently coming in. It would affect how much profit the people who own the building would be able to take in. So that's, yeah, typically a lot of the time, yes, the building may need some improvements, but in my opinion, that should be the building owner's responsibility, not the tenant's responsibility.
Right, right. And they know that when they buy that. So, it says more luxury apartments are built than affordable apartments. And, you know, I see that happening around here. They're turning commercial spaces into not affordable apartments, but apartments that are $1,600 to $2,200 a month that people that have low income cannot afford. And that's what's needed.
You can even make the median income cannot afford.
Right. And the reason that they, when I talked to like the Contractors Association and stuff, they do not see a profit in building low income or affordable apartments. And they cannot get investors to do that. So there again, that's the money. So.
Yeah. So we're going to kind of go back to what Don was talking about earlier, where wealthy tenants or people who have more money move into historically low income areas. There's a term for that. And I wanted to make sure that we do talk about it because I think it gets talked about a lot. And if you don't know what it means, it can be really confusing. The term is gentrification. And so that's when people who have more wealth, more access to money, move into an area where typically poor people have lived, right? And they do that for many reasons, because the rent is cheaper, because they can buy a building and renovate it and then rent it out to other people. It's profit driven. And then this is something that's happening across the country where it displaces people who can't then afford those luxury rent prices, because all that's available are these new high-end buildings where the rent is $1,500, $2,000 a month, and the people who lived in that area before can't afford those rents. And this is something that a lot of the time gets talked about as an urban thing, something that happens in cities, but I think it's really important to mention that gentrification it's happening nationwide, and it does affect rural areas as well. And if you look in like the rings outside of those urban areas, those urban centers, there's a lot of rural land, farmland, pasture land that has become suburbs because in order to provide housing for the people who work in those urban centers. So this doesn't just affect cities, it affects people who live in both urban and rural environments. So what programs currently exist to help people find affordable housing, Don?
So there are housing vouchers. You hear about a housing voucher when you talk to people and you hear about Section 8. Here's a picture of a Section 8 waiting list or wait list. A lot of places don't have a technical waiting list or like that, hopefully. But Section 8 is one of the best known, I think, besides HUD for a housing program.
Yes, and it's through Section 8 you can register for a housing voucher, which if you qualify, will pay 70% of your rent. You pay 30% of your rent, and then as long as you follow rules and are a good tenant, you can keep that voucher pretty much forever. So a lot of times we call it the golden ticket.
They do have quite a few rules, and especially getting on is a little tricky sometimes for people.
Yeah, the wait lists typically are years long, and many times, I know in Utah, they would open the wait list for short periods of time and then close it to try to sift through the people on that list. And so people would wait 3, 4, 5 years before hearing back, right? And you have to make sure that you stay at the same address, because they'll send you a letter to when your name comes up on the list. And it's a lengthy, arduous process that puts a large burden on the person seeking the voucher.
But if you are a person that is at a center, and especially if you're helping somebody who is in temporary housing or at a shelter, at least here, you know, Section 8 will send mail to general delivery. And because they do have to have a mailing list or mailing address, and being in a shelter, you know, they don't have an address. So that's what we were trying to do, to get a lot of people from shelter to housing. And you know, our waiting list had been like 45 days. So it was moving pretty quick. And especially with people with disabilities, you know, that moves quicker. So it's just making sure you have everything that you need, plus once you're on that for a year, you can end up going wherever you want with that. It's portable. So you just have to make sure you give 30 days notice to your landlord. So yeah, it's a good deal. Subsidized housing is a little different, and people don't really understand the difference. So Dylan, as you understand subsidized housing, what do you know? And then,
so there are different categories. There's government-owned subsidized housing, and then there's corporate-owned subsidized housing. And the way that they are funded is different. So sometimes a housing authority will have a building, there'll be maybe houses, maybe an apartment building, and they can rent those out at a price that is maybe set at 30% of the fair market rent in the area, or they would determine it based on 30% of the renter's income. And that's the government, the housing authority option. There's also some subsidized housing that is owned by private corporations that get tax credits and tax benefits to help cover the gap of what they're losing on rent prices. And they just charge what a lower rent price and have a pretty stringent application process for people to get in. A lot of them are targeted for people who are 55 and older, or specifically people with disabilities. Sometimes they call them tax credit apartments. Right. But yeah, there's lots of different categories of subsidized housing, but it's typically where someone else is helping to foot the bill of the rent, be it the government or a private corporation.
And some of the government subsidized housing is not taken care of as well as the corporate owned or privately owned subsidized housing, just because, well, I don't want to say it's because the government owns it, but you know, the government owns it.
Question.
Yes.
I'm still a little confused the difference between Section 8 and subsidized housing. Aren't both of them based on a percentage of your rent if you qualify for that program?
Yes.
First question. And then second question, how come it seems to be harder to get a hold of a Section 8 voucher versus maybe a subsidized housing place to rent? Trying to find the words.
Okay, these are good questions, and I think I'm going to answer them in the opposite order that you asked them. So there are often wait lists for subsidized housing as well in public housing. You may have a 6 month to a year wait list because they're probably full. Most of the time they're full. They may have one or two vacancies, but they have to be able to go in and clean the apartment, make sure it's suitable for a new tenant. So it's typically a little faster to get into one of those housing authority subsidized program houses, but it's based on a specific building or a specific group of houses. So they know exactly how many units they have and how many they can rent out. Section 8 is basically just like writing you a check and saying anyone who will take this Section 8 voucher, you can use it there. So a lot of apartments who typically would not be subsidized, don't have this arrangement with other people, would accept that Section 8 voucher, take some money from the government and some money from the tenant. And so because you are able to shop around a little more on Section 8. That's why it's typically a little more restrictive. Do you have any thoughts about
that? So just in summary, so there are certain apartments that are set aside for subsidized housing, and then Section 8, you actually have to find somebody that's going to accept that voucher.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah. And Section 8 has, you know, has the list of people that do Section 8, but there are always other people that will do Section 8. And you can ask, even if you're looking through apartment listings, you can ask them, even if they don't say, or if they're not on the list, you can ask them if they would do Section 8, and then they can make an arrangement with the Section 8 office.
Yeah. And there are some places, like in King County, Washington, where I live, it's illegal to refuse a Section 8 voucher. So you can't turn away someone because they're paying using a voucher to help pay for their housing. And so if that's something that you think is important to you, you could advocate for a law like that in your own community.
I was about to say, why is that not nationwide? Because that would be very helpful to our consumers.
Yeah, it would. It would be. Profit, man.
Yes.
Okay, and there are some housing assistance programs that you can reach out to as well. I typically just like Google. I think it's a great friend, housing assistance programs near me. I Googled for Seattle, and this is what popped up. There's a Seattle Senior Housing Program. It's a property management company that probably has access to affordable housing for seniors. The Seattle Housing Authority has public housing, some subsidized housing available. There's another low-income housing project it brought up called Center Park. And there are even some places that will help you pay your rent. If you already have an apartment and you're at risk of eviction, then you can apply to get some rental assistance to help pay for your, cover the gap in your rent or pay for your energy bills if you don't have enough money for heat. So there are some local resources. It depends a lot about where you live that might be able to help cover those bills if you already have the apartment.
Absolutely.
So we've so much to talk about today. We're a little behind schedule. So I want to try to get through this quickly so we can move on to our short or small group discussions. So we want to talk a little bit about what other countries do. We think we have a pretty good grasp of what the problem is with housing in the United States. So let's look around, because this isn't just a United States issue. This is a global issue. There's a graph on this screen that talks about housing affordability across the world. And a lot of places that we've talked about in the United States, like San Francisco and San Francisco is pretty high on the list, but it's not the highest. Like Melbourne, Australia, Vancouver, Canada, Sydney, Australia, and Hong Kong, their affordability coefficients are multiple the time. So it's like way, way less affordable to find. This is a really confusing graph, but it's a lot less affordable in Hong Kong and Sydney than it is in San Francisco. So this is something that's happening all over the world. And one thing that lots of places are doing is something called rent control, which is where the government sets a regulation that limits how much a landlord can charge for rent. So it would say that if in a certain area, based on the income that people make, you can't charge more than, say, if the fair market rent is $1,300, they'd say, okay, that's the cap. You can't charge any more than this. Sometimes governments do this in blanket forms, but not very often. Most often it's specific programs to specific buildings. And one program I want to talk about is Berlin in 2016, which decided to cap the rent prices on all of their state-owned housing. So all of the housing that was owned by the housing authority in Berlin, they said the rent is going to be capped at whatever 30% of that tenant's income is. And This is in Berlin. I did some research. 15% of the residents in Berlin are in public housing. So this isn't an insignificant portion of the people. It's 15% who are going to be paying less than 30% of their income. And the income qualification is $18,000 a year, which is equivalent to a low income household. It's 50% of the median family income in Berlin. We've talked, rent control is not new in the United States. It's something that has been discussed for about a century. First started coming up in the 1930s around the Great Depression, and some states like New York and California, which had big cities at that time where rent prices were going out of control, we were seeing similar problems to what we see today. They put in rent control in some of their buildings to be able to keep manageable. So once you signed a lease with an apartment, your rent would be locked in and they wouldn't be able to increase the rent that you own per year. And those laws have now changed that even in a rent-controlled apartment, they can increase your rent by a certain percentage. But in the vast majority of the United States, all these blue states, they actually prohibit rent control, right? Because it's anti-profit. It doesn't allow for landowners to be able to make money on the buildings that they have because it controls how much they can charge. There are some arguments against that most of the time that it will increase rent.
Question.
Yes.
Sure. So the states that are in white, they say none. So what does that mean?
That means that they don't have any laws. It's not that there are some existing programs or that they have explicitly banned rent control. They just haven't talked about rent control at all.
So it can go either way.
Yeah, really? It can go either way in those states because the conversation hasn't been had yet.
Okay.
Yeah, good question. Oh, and the arguments against rent control are that it incentivizes apartment owners to turn them into condos because they can make more money selling them as condos than they would be able to by renting them out as low-income or rent-controlled apartments. And it decreases the availability of housing because people stop building apartments. Because again, if you're not going to make money on it, nobody wants to do it. So all of the arguments against rent control typically are because of decisions made by those investors, not because of actual issues that come from rent control, in my opinion. Some other things, like Tokyo has allowed for a lot of rezoning. Tokyo has the most relaxed zoning laws in the world. Most cities, they say there are certain areas where you're allowed to build high-rise apartments and other areas are built as residential, so they have to be houses or can be less, have to be less than two or three stories. Or if it's a commercial area and there are shops, then you may not be allowed to build houses there. Tokyo doesn't really have any of those laws. And so because of that, their rent prices for a two-bedroom apartment are like $1,000. And it's been that way for almost 15 years because there are a lot more taller and denser buildings in the downtown area. The government has allowed private contractors to issue permits, which typically is a government job. The government says who's allowed to build a building. And in Tokyo, they contract that job out so that other people are doing it, which offers more opportunity to build these houses, which are apparently still profitable because people keep building them. And another strategy is to tax foreign investors. So to disincentivize people from another country coming in to build a large luxury apartment complex and then just take the walk off with all of the money. They applied special taxes to foreign investors who are investing in real estate projects in order to incentivize local people to work on housing projects in their own communities. So now that we've talked about the problem, wow, we've only got like 9 minutes. So the US has a shortage of 7 million rental homes that are affordable and available to extremely low income renter households. And the solution that's proposed here is to increase investments in housing projects and to increase the rental assistance programs to help people pay their rent. So if we could break into small groups for 5 minutes and talk about how you think we could approach this issue, what potential solutions you could come up with in your community to make housing more affordable to people who need it. Love to do that.
Okay, really quick, just for everybody to know, I'm going to break up all the groups. And once I do that, they will ask you to join the group. So once you join the group, then you'll be able to start in the conversation. And remember, you can mute and unmute yourselves. And just a reminder to Dylan and Don, once you get in there, if you could hit record. And your options. And if you need help, that's okay. So I'm going to break you up. And if you have any questions, just let me know.
Okay, come back at 12:56.
Perfect. Thank you. And I'll give you a warning at 12:55. And once you accept, then you can join in those different groups.
Do I have to stop sharing?
I don't think so, because it's going to kick you out of this room, I believe. Well, as we have joining back, we have learned so much along this.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Practice in advance.
Yeah. Well, thank you. For bearing with us. We're probably going to have a couple more people drop in once that minute is up.
Okay.
But so we just ran out of time, I think.
Yeah, since small group conversation is not really happening, I would love to hear any comments or ideas that people have of how local communities that you're working with have been approaching affordable housing or what ideas you think might be worth looking into to make housing more available to people who need it.
And remember, you can drop in. Hi, guys. Welcome back. Dylan just asked the main group, what are some of your ideas? Because I think we just ran out of small group time. So if y'all want to drop that in the chat box, if you don't have a mic or don't have access to that, or you can unmute or mute or press *6 if I can get all the options out. How do we fix this? What do we do going forward from here? What ideas have you used that work? What ideas have you used that do not work?
This is Mel speaking. In my experience, specifically in the Pacific Northwest and in the city that I live in, is being a part of your legislative process. It's almost every single legislative session, something is going up on the floor that is about housing. And this past year, we had a bill going up to the legislature that was about the rights of a landlord, and more so the rights of the tenant to be able to kick out a landlord. And but when I showed up to speak about the issue, we had a huge amount of corporate interest showing up that was a lot louder than the people there, because a lot of the people didn't know that they could go there to voice it. And so the main voice that was being heard about this issue were landlords that weren't the mom and pop landlords, but the larger corporations being like, oh, we don't want to have these restrictions because that will restrict our profits. So making sure that your voice is heard there at those town halls. I know that Oregon, this past legislative session, just passed a statewide rent control bill. And that, I think that's the first of its kind for the complete state to have rent control. So, and that all came from the legislative process.
Cool. Thanks, Mels. That's great.
And there was a comment. Do you have a link to that? I'm not sure if you were referring to Mel's or if you're referring to Teresa's comment, which says cities to offer tax incentives on breaks on new construction that gives more 10% of space for affordable housing.
Oh, so you were talking to Mel's. So okay. A link to Oregon's law that they just passed, or to perhaps video of the town hall meeting?
And Teresa, were you saying that cities should offer the tax incentives or breaks on new constructions, or you're against that? I was trying to.
No, I'm saying that if more tax incentives and breaks are offered to the new construction, that if they give more than 10% of their space to affordable housing, currently where I live, it's about 10% is all that they're required to give. And in 100 units, that's only 10 units. So that doesn't really cover an area that has, you know, a couple hundred thousand people looking for homes. And the cities and states gave higher tax incentives and breaks to the new construction that offered, say, 20, 25% of their homes to be a lower income or affordable. That would create more houses around this area. I live in Boulder County, and it's one of the most expensive areas right now, too.
Yeah, so that's a great idea, being able to talk with your legislature and having a voice in the what gets passed, because the tax breaks are great, but if that's still not creating enough units, then we still need to make more aggressive changes in order to solve the problem, right? Because all rent control, subsidized housing, housing assistance programs, zoning, rent, and all of those programs we've talked about worldwide have helped, but nothing has been able to solve this problem, right? This is still a problem that's been around for centuries at this point. People are not able to afford a place to live. So, yeah.
And to add on to that, even though those programs are there to help, there's not enough houses to put people in, even if they find that program. If they're lucky enough to get through the wait list and get onto one of those programs, they still can't find a house because the rent is just so high, people can't afford anything. And I was also going to add in there that in this area, we are working on the tiny home projects. And I think that is also a great way to help with affordable housing, because you can build 10 tiny homes for the cost of one home. And that would fit. The tiny homes now come with up to 2 bedrooms, and you could fit a single family into one of those homes. Or a single parent with one child can live in one of those spaces, and it would be much more affordable.
Yeah. And that even starts to talk about issues such as even environmental sustainability, being able to make a tiny home that has solar panels and that doesn't require plumbing, so that you can, yeah, I think that that's a really interesting and good conversation to be having. It's maybe expanding our idea of what housing looks like.
So this is Dawn, and I think what we do not have nationally is a tenant advocacy group, like a national one, where that can be sustained. We can have, you know, power, more power, because we will have people in more states. More people would end up listening to what people would be saying. We would get more information out to people. So you use that advocacy, you use that information, and you're able to get that out to the legislative sessions. You're able to get that out to city councils. You're able to get that out to, you know, board of supervisors, whomever it would work on the best. And, but it's that advocacy, it's starting that, it's getting that movement going.
Yeah. And it looks like Ashley made a comment about working with a legal group in her area called the Hope Fair Housing. And I think that's great. Finding organizations that are already doing this work and connecting with them, because we don't have to start everything from the ground up. This is a conversation that's been going on for a long time. It's just finding the people who are involved in the fight and being able to support them. Wow. Well, we are over on time. Any final questions before we get going?
Yeah, this is really great. Thank you all for being a part of this conversation. And Dylan and Don, thank you. I think that was 5. For every presentation you guys have been a part of in facilitating this, I have really enjoyed learning along with everybody else. And just a note, because I'm that nerd, if you would follow the evaluation link, we want to know how this worked for you. What did you get out of it? How did it improve your knowledge? And how will it impact your advocacy for yourself or for others going forward? So please follow that link. And also remember that we can continue this conversation. You can continue this with the Youth Advocacy Committee that we have at April. And so if I can click to it really quick, you'll see the next one. It's the meets the fourth Wednesday of each month at 2:00 Eastern time. So please note that in your calendar for June. If you want to continue this conversation, we can have a conversation directly on housing and questions that you still have lingering. And then we'll also talk about much, much more on there as well. Thank you again for everybody joining. Please fill out that survey link or that evaluation link. And we hope that you all have a really great day. Thank you all again.
Thank you.